Winston S. Churchill, The Second World War, Volume 1, The Gathering Storm. The Second World War was the greatest historical drama that the world has ever seen. It needed a man whose stature was of similar proportions to write its history, and I would venture to say that my grandfather was such a man. In these six volumes, he gives a fine historical account of events, passes judgment upon those events, and produces a story that amply exemplifies the need for statesmen to observe the moral that he chose for this work. In war, resolution. In defeat, defiance. In victory, magnanimity. In peace, goodwill. In this, the first of the six volumes, he recounts the errors committed at the end of the First World War, the tragedy of America's failure to enter the League of Nations, and the weakness and lack of resolution of the democracies in their failure to confront the aggressors, Japan, Italy, and Germany, before it was too late. This then is largely prologue to the war itself. But before that prologue, let us listen to my grandfather's own words and how he set the scene and tone of the account that is to follow. In these pages, I attempt to recount some of the incidents and impressions which form in my mind the story of the coming upon mankind of the worst tragedy in its tumultuous history. In the Second World War, every bond between man and man was to perish. Crimes were committed by the Germans under the Hitlerite domination, to which they allowed themselves to be subjected, which find no equal in scale and wickedness with any that have darkened the human record. The wholesale massacre, by systematized processes, of 6 or 7 millions of men, women, and children in the German execution camps exceeds in horror the rough and ready butcheries of Genghis Khan, and in scale reduces them to pygmy proportions. Deliberate extermination of whole populations was contemplated and pursued by both Germany and Russia in the Eastern War. The hideous process of bombarding open cities from the air, once started by the Germans, was repaid 20-fold by the ever-mounting power of the Allies, and found its culmination in the use of the atomic bombs, which obliterated Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It is my purpose, as one who lived and acted in these days, to show how easily the tragedy of the Second World War could have been prevented. How the malice of the wicked was reinforced by the weakness of the virtuous. How the structure and habits of democratic states, unless they are welded into larger organisms, lack those elements of persistence and conviction which can alone give security to humble masses. How, even in matters of self-preservation, no policy is pursued for even 10 or 15 years at a time. We shall see how the counsels of prudence and restraint may become the prime agents of mortal danger, how the middle course, adopted from desires for safety and a quiet life, may be found to lead direct to the bullseye of disaster. We shall see how absolute is the need of a broad path of international action pursued by many states in common across the years, irrespective of the ebb and flow of national politics. It was a simple policy to keep Germany disarmed and the victors adequately armed for 30 years, and in the meanwhile, even if a reconciliation could not be made with Germany, to build ever more strongly a true League of Nations capable of making sure that treaties were kept or changed only by discussion and agreement. When 3 or 4 powerful governments acting together have demanded the most fearful sacrifices from their peoples, when these have been given freely for the common cause, and when the longed-for result has been attained, it would seem reasonable that concerted action should be preserved so that at least the essentials would not be cast away. But this modest requirement, the might, civilization, learning, knowledge, science of the victors were unable to supply. They live from hand to mouth, from day to day, from one election to another, until, when scarcely 20 years were out, the dread signal of the Second World War was given. And we must write of the sons of those who had fought and died so faithfully and well. Shoulder to aching shoulder, side by side, they trudged away from life's broad wields of light.
After the end of the World War of 1914, there was a deep conviction and almost universal hope that peace would reign in the world. This heart's desire of all the peoples could easily have been gained by steadfastness in righteous convictions and by reasonable common sense and prudence. The phrase, "the war to end war," was on every lip, and measures had been taken to turn it into reality. President Wilson, wielding, as was thought, the authority of the United States, had made the conception of a League of Nations dominant in all minds. The Allied armies stood along the Rhine, and their bridgeheads bulged deeply into defeated, disarmed, and hungry Germany. The chiefs of the victor powers debated and disputed the future in Paris. Before them lay the map of Europe, to be redrawn almost as they might resolve. After 52 months of agony and hazards, the Teutonic coalition lay at their mercy, and not one of its four members could offer the slightest resistance to their will. Germany, the head and front of the offense, regarded by all as the prime cause of the catastrophe which had fallen upon the world, was at the mercy or discretion of conquerors, themselves reeling from the torment they had endured. Moreover, this had been a war not of governments, but of peoples. The whole life energy of the greatest nations had been poured out in wrath and slaughter. The war leaders assembled in Paris in the summer of 1919 had been borne thither upon the strongest and most furious tides that have ever flowed in human history. Gone were the days of the treaties of Utrecht and Vienna, when aristocratic statesmen and diplomats, victor and vanquished alike, met in polite and courtly disputation, and, free from the clatter and babel of democracy, could reshape systems upon the fundamentals of which they were all agreed. The peoples, transported by their sufferings and by the mass teachings with which they had been inspired, stood around in scores of millions to demand that retribution should be exacted to the full. Woe betide the leaders now perched on their dizzy pinnacles of triumph if they cast away at the conference table what the soldiers had won on 100 blood-soaked battlefields. Tragically, the arrangements for peace were fatally flawed. Germany was humiliated and had to suffer punitive reparations. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was broken up and southeastern Europe balkanized, and the U.S. Senate rejected both America's membership of the League of Nations and an Anglo-American guarantee of French security. These American actions undermined the chances for collective security in an unstable and troubled Europe, and, in particular, worried France, which feared Germany's potential to revive and again embark on military expansion. Nevertheless, one solid security for peace remained. Germany was disarmed. All her artillery and weapons were destroyed. Her fleet had already sunk itself in Scarpa Flow. Her vast army was disbanded. By the Treaty of Versailles, only a professional long service army, not exceeding 100,000 men, and unable on this basis to accumulate reserves, was permitted to Germany for purposes of internal order. The annual quotas of recruits no longer received their training. The cadres were dissolved. Every effort was made to reduce to a tithe the officer corps. No military air force of any kind was allowed. Submarines were forbidden, and the German Navy was limited to a handful of vessels under 10,000 tons. Soviet Russia was barred off from Western Europe by a cordon of violently anti-Bolshevik states who had broken away from the former empire of the Tsars in its new and more terrible form. Poland and Czechoslovakia raised independent heads and seemed to stand erect in Central Europe. Hungary had recovered from her dose of Béla Kun, the communist dictator. The French army, resting upon its laurels, was incomparably the strongest military force in Europe, and it was for some years believed that the French Air Force was also of a high order. Up till the year 1934, the power of the conquerors remained unchallenged in Europe, and indeed throughout the world. There was no moment in these 16 years when the three former allies, or even Britain and France, with their associates in Europe, could not, in the name of the League of Nations, and under its moral and international shield, have controlled by a mere effort of the will the armed strength of Germany. Instead, until 1931, the victors, and particularly the United States, concentrated their efforts upon extorting by vexatious foreign controls their annual reparations from Germany. The fact that these payments were made only from far larger American loans reduced the whole process to the absurd. Nothing was reaped except ill will. On the other hand, the strict enforcement at any time till 1934 of the disarmament clauses of the peace treaty would have guarded indefinitely, without violence or bloodshed, the peace and safety of mankind. But this was neglected, while the infringements remained petty and shunned as they assumed serious proportions. Thus, the final safeguard of a long peace was cast away. The crimes of the vanquished find their background and their explanation, though not, of course, their pardon, in the follies of the victors. Without these follies, crime would have found neither temptation nor opportunity. In the 1920s, peace was at its zenith. On the 4th of October, 1925, the Locarno Conference was formally opened. By the waters of this calm lake, the delegates of Britain, France, Germany, Belgium, and Italy assembled. The conference achieved, first, a treaty of mutual guarantee between the five powers. Secondly, arbitration treaties between Germany and France, Germany and Belgium, Germany and Poland, Germany and Czechoslovakia. Thirdly, special agreements between France and Poland, and France and Czechoslovakia, by which France undertook to afford them assistance if a breakdown of the Western Pact were followed by an unprovoked resort to arms. Thus did the Western European democracies agree to keep the peace among themselves in all circumstances, and to stand united against any one of their number who broke the contract and marched in aggression upon a brother land. However, in the Far East, things were less satisfactory. The United States made it clear to Britain that the continuance of her 1902 alliance with Japan, to which the Japanese had punctiliously conformed, would constitute a barrier in Anglo-American relations. Accordingly, this alliance was brought to an end. The annulment caused a profound impression in Japan and was viewed as the spurning of an Asiatic power by the Western world. Many links were sundered, which might afterwards have proved of decisive value to peace. However, peace was still uppermost in many minds as the 1920s drew to a close. One consequence of this was the World Disarmament Conference in Geneva, 1932 to 1934. But also in these years came Hitler. In October 1918, a German corporal had been temporarily blinded by mustard gas in a British attack near Comin. While he lay in hospital in Pomerania, defeat and revolution swept over Germany. The son of an obscure Austrian customs official, he had nursed youthful dreams of becoming a great artist. Having failed to gain entry to the Academy of Art in Vienna, he had lived in poverty in that capital, and later in Munich. Sometimes as a house painter, often as a casual laborer, he suffered physical privations and bred a harsh, though concealed, resentment that the world had denied him success. These misfortunes did not lead him into communist ranks. By an honorable inversion, he cherished all the more an abnormal sense of racial loyalty and a fervent and mystic admiration for Germany and the German people. He sprang eagerly to arms at the outbreak of the war and served for 4 years with a Bavarian regiment on the Western Front. Such were the early fortunes of Adolf Hitler. At the beginning, Hitler had made it clear that the path to power lay through aggression and violence against a Weimar Republic born from the shame of defeat.